like this is the Christmas passage, one of the ones that we go back to time and time again, and yet it's rough. It's like, can this marriage be saved before it even starts? And so we're looking at that part of Isaiah 9. We're spending the entire month on Isaiah 9. Now, Darlene just read Matthew 1. But Isaiah 9, if you want to turn to that passage, verses 1 through 7. I talked last week about the background of that and how Israel was at a difficult time. But Isaiah saw the day when the people walking in darkness would see a great light. And then the verse that we're going to focus on today is verse 6, which says, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given." That's our focus for this morning. I was reading a commentary once years ago, and I was kind of shocked by what this person said. He was talking about one of the Gospels, and he said, "You know, the Gospel writers don't really praise Jesus." And I went back and said, "What?" And I realized he was true. It was true. In other words, they're not like cheerleaders that are trying to manipulate you into, you know, believing in something. They're not like, they're not even as, you know, praising Jesus in the same way that the Psalms do. They're not like, "Yay, this is the greatest thing that's ever come along. You've got to do this. Isn't he wonderful?" They do it a little bit, but the point is, the gospel writers portray the life of Jesus like a news story. You know, you read the beginning of Luke, and he goes into great detail. "I looked at eyewitness accounts. I wanted to be very accurate. Here's the information. I want you to decide." I like what Josh McDowell said. He said, the writers of Scripture invite us to examine this person, Jesus, for ourselves and to conclude for ourselves his significance. They wrote it all out, and they said, "This is what we saw happen. We want you to know about it, and we want you to come to the same conclusion we have." Philip Yancey says, "It occurs to me that all the contorted theories about Jesus have been spontaneously generating since the day of his death merely confirm the awesome risk God took when he stretched himself out on the dissection table, a risk he seemed to welcome. Examine me, test me, you decide." So I want to look at this idea of a child being born in four different ways. I want to realize that he was born according to a plan, that he was born in a surprising way, that he was born making himself vulnerable, and the last point is that he came to our rescue. So a child was born according to plan, and that's what I want to look at first, that this wasn't something God just, you know, came up with off the cuff or didn't really think about very much. In fact, there's 44 prophecies at least about the birth of Jesus. I'm just going to show you 9 of them, all right? There's even more about the death of Jesus and the resurrection. But let me talk specifically about what the Bible tells us to look for and how it was from the very beginning saying this person is going to come, this child is going to be born, and the child is going to be born. The Messiah will come from, number one, the seed of a woman. And you're probably going, "Okay, well, duh, Steve, if it's a baby, it's probably coming from a woman, right?" But let me go into more detail. In the very beginning of the Bible, the third chapter of the Bible, God is talking to this serpent. I don't have time to go into a lot of detail on this, but remember that there's Adam and Eve, and then the serpent comes along, and serpent's kind of battling with them, and then he kind of manipulates Eve into thinking God's not good, and so things don't go well. They eat from the tree like they're not supposed to. And God says to the serpent, "I will put enmity," which is like warfare, "between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He'll crush your head, and you will strike his heel." Now, it's a mysterious passage, and you're probably going, "What does that mean?" But the bottom line is, there's this serpent and there's this woman, and they're both going to have offspring. And the offspring of the serpent, which we'll find out if you go to the end of the Bible, the book of Revelation, it says the serpent is Satan. So God says, excuse me, that the serpent is, his head's going to get crushed. And the child of the woman, the serpent is going to strike his heel. Now, what would you rather have? Your head crushed or your heel hurt? You'd probably rather have my heel hurt, right? So in other words, getting your head crushed means you're dead, you're gone forever, you're destroyed. Having your heel hurt and damaged means there's going to be some damage in the process, but you're going to survive. And so you've got this realization at the end of the Bible that Satan is going to be destroyed, and the one who's going to destroy him is this child of this woman, and his name is Jesus, and he is going to get damaged in the process. But he's going to survive, right? And the point made here is that there is going to be this mysterious figure who's going to come from a woman. And you go, well, that kind of doesn't narrow it down very much, but it's going to be a boy. So that's half of the kids. It's going to be a boy, not a girl. Then in Genesis 22, God is speaking to Abraham, and he says this. He says, through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed because you've obeyed me. So now of all the people in the whole world that have ever existed, it's going to be a Jewish boy. It's going to come from Abraham. It's going to be able to trace his lineage back to Abraham, the race of the Jews. Thirdly, the Messiah will come from the line of Isaac. Abraham has two sons, right? Ishmael, Isaac. All the Muslims trace their lineage back to Ishmael. It says here in Genesis 21, God speaking to Abraham, don't be so distressed about the boy and your slave woman. Remember, his slave woman Hagar had a child too, Ishmael. Listen to whatever Sarah tells you, because it's through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. So it's Abraham, then it's Isaac, and Isaac has two sons, Esau and Jacob, right? And Balaam, a prophet in Numbers 24, says, I see him. He's kind of looking to the future. He sees this mysterious figure, this Messiah. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star will come out of Jacob. A scepter will rise out of Israel. Actually, Jacob's name became Israel. So it's the race of the Jews through Abraham, through his son Isaac, not Ishmael, and through Jacob, not Esau. So this is beginning to narrow it down. And then Jacob has 12 tribes. There's 12 tribes of Israel. So one of these tribes is going to be the place the Messiah is going to come from. And in Genesis 49, Jacob, near the end of his life, he's looking at all his kids, and he says, Judah, out of your tribe, the Messiah is going to come. He says, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nation shall be his. So it's from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the tribe of Judah, and then somewhere down the line, in the tribe of Judah is going to be some guy named Jesse. And we find that out two chapters beyond chapter 9 in Isaiah. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. So now it's this guy, Jesse. And we find out that Jesse was, born much later than Isaiah. Earlier than Isaiah. But he has eight sons. So which of them is it going to be? Well, remember from 1 Samuel, they're going through all the sons, and they pick David. So we find out in Jeremiah 23 that the Messiah is going to be through David. He wasn't just a king, but he's the place that the Messiah is going to come from. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I'll raise up for David a righteous branch, a king who will reign wisely and do what is just and right in the land. So it's Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the tribe of Judah, this guy named Jesse, his son David, and then it's going to come from a particular town, a town that's not very big. It's still not that big. Bethlehem is a suburb of Jerusalem. It's only about 5 miles away, and back then it was really small, but that was where David came from. So in Micah chapter 5 says, but you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. Sounds great, right? Except you're going, wait a minute. This young teenage couple, Joseph and Mary, they're not from Bethlehem. They're living up in Nazareth, way up in the north. How are they going to get to Bethlehem to fulfill the prophecy? Well, God kind of has a way of organizing world events. So the emperor says, everybody has to go to their hometown to be registered. And so they got to take this journey After they find out that she's pregnant, they got to get on a donkey or whatever it is, or walk all the way down the whole length of the country down to Bethlehem, because that's where Joseph was from. That's where his family was from, and therefore it fulfills this prophecy. So it's from the line of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, Jesse, David, Bethlehem. It's got to come from there, and you're still going, well, that's maybe a lot of guys born in Bethlehem, except there's one more point that's kind of unusual. The mom's going to be a virgin. Okay, so if you narrow it down to that, that kind of weeds out a lot of people, right? And this is the passage that we heard from Matthew chapter 1, Isaiah 14, therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. Call him Emmanuel. We might be familiar with this, but if you think about it, it's pretty wild, right? Back in the day, I don't even know when, there used to be this TV show called 30-something. And so on the TV show, there was this couple, and Hope was the wife, and she was a Christian, and Michael was the husband, and he was Jewish. So one day, Hope says, hey, Michael, why do you even bother with Hanukkah? By the way, Hanukkah is like Christmas Eve this year, right? And she says, do you really believe that a handful of Jews held off a huge army by using a bunch of lamps that miraculously wouldn't run out of oil? Really? Are you going to celebrate that for 8 days? And he goes, yeah. Well, does Christmas make any more sense? Do you really believe an angel appeared to some teenage girl who then got pregnant without ever having sex and traveled on horseback to Bethlehem, where she spent the night in a barn and had a baby who turned out to be the savior of the world? She's going, well, yeah. But that does sound a little far-fetched, doesn't it? And yet you can see that God had a plan. So the baby was born according to a plan. The second point is the child was born in a surprising way. And what I mean by surprising is the actual birth was normal. The way she got pregnant wasn't normal. She was a virgin. But this child is surprising. In the sense, this child's not just an ordinary child. This child is God in human form. He's God incarnate. Incarnate means flesh. And so he took on flesh. It says in Colossians chapter 2, all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form in Jesus. Now, we're used to that, but that's an astonishing thing, right? This baby is going to be God in the flesh. That's surprising. A child is born to us. That tells us that he's human, fully 100% human. A son is given refers, I think, to the idea that he's the divine son of God. And so you've got God becoming a baby. That's pretty surprising. In John 1, it says, the word, the eternal word of God, became flesh and dwelt among us. He's incarnate. That's amazing. Back 20 years ago, there was a gal named Joan Osborne. I think she kind of hit her peak musically about then when she released this song called One of Us. Do you ever remember this? It went like this. I'm not going to sing it. I'll just say it. You can calm down. What if God was one of us? Just a slob like one of us. Just a stranger on the bus trying to make his way home. What if God had a face? What would it look like? What if God had a name? What would it be? What if God was one of us? He became one of us. I got on the plane about a year and a half ago to go see my mom in Florida because she was sick. And this guy named Gary was sitting next to me. And I tried to make it really clear that I just wanted to read a book, you know? But Gary was a talker, and he was having none of that. I mean, I kept, he'd talk, he'd ask a question, go back and forth. I'd go back to my book, and because I'm a Christian, I need to read books. I was probably reading a book about why you should talk to people on airplanes. But I was reading this book, you know, and it didn't matter to him. I thought I could have held it up in his face, and he would have, like, just kept talking. He just wanted to talk. It's a 3-hour flight. He's a talker, man. That's going to go on the whole flight. And early on, he found out I was a pastor, so he goes, what do you think God looks like? Pretty good question. I was like, that's a great question. I think he looks a lot like Jesus. So we kept going on. He goes, yeah, I was raised a Christian, but I don't believe that anymore. And I got questions about, you know, why is the world so evil and all these terrible things and all that. So we had a long conversation, and we've kind of kept up a little bit of an email correspondence since. I just sent him something I want to hear back. But he wanted to know what God looks like. Everybody wants to know what God looks like, right? And Jesus, is, even Thomas, you know, was it Thomas? I forget. Said, you know, just show us the Father. Jesus goes, guys, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And so his incarnation meant that he had to mold himself into one of us. There was a guy named Dr. Robert Sizer, and he wrote a book years and years ago called Mortal Lessons, Notes in the Art of Surgery. And he tells about this one case where this woman has a tumor in her face, and so he has to get the tumor out. He's got to cut a nerve in her, and so that her mouth gets twisted, but he had to do it that way. And so he describes the situation. They're in the room, and here's the woman in bed, and her husband's on the other side, and he says her young husband is in the room. He stands on the opposite side of the bed, and together they seem to do pretty well in the evening lamplight, isolated from me, private. The young woman speaks. Will my mouth always be like this? She says, and I say, yes, it will. It's because the nerve was cut. She nods and is silent, but the young man smiles. He says, I like it. It's kind of cute. And unmindful, he bends to kiss her crooked mouth. And I'm so close, I can see how he twists his own lips to accommodate to hers, to show her that their kiss still works. Now in that story, who are we and who's Jesus? He's the one that has to twist himself, right? He's got to accommodate himself to us. I don't think it was much of a picnic coming to earth, finding out what things were like here. I always think, well, maybe Jesus went back to heaven and said, you won't believe how those people live down there. It's amazing. We're the twisted ones. But he twisted himself to fit us. Amazing. So he made himself vulnerable. That's the third point. He came, surprisingly, it's God in human form. He's God incarnate. He's a child, but he's the Son, and he's vulnerable. He didn't come, he wasn't a bubble boy. You know, bubble boy, like, you know, nothing can get to me. He didn't have like a coat of armor, you know, like Iron Man. He didn't fly around. He came to this place and it was not that safe, right? He came here and he's born in the equivalent of a taxi, right? There's always some story in the newspaper about, oh, yesterday a woman was born. She didn't get there on time, had to be born in the taxi. And you're going, man, that's not the plan, is it? That's not the way you, hey, let's just, you know, kind of wait till, you know, I was talking to somebody here. Somebody's going to have a baby in a week. I'm sure they've got the whole thing planned, you know, the whole route, the stuff that's going to go in the car, the bag that's going to go to the hospital, and all that stuff. I mean, what if it just doesn't work out the way you have the baby in the taxi or something? That's what happened to Jesus. The king of the world is born in a taxi, essentially, a manger, okay? And then some people come along and go, hey, they go to Jerusalem, where's the new king? And the old king's going, what do you mean the new king? Oh, well, you know, we looked at the stars and all this, we found out there's like a new king that was just born, right? And the King Herod is going, hey, tell me about this new king. I haven't really heard about him. Tell me where he's from. I'd like to worship him. He really wants to kill him, right? And so he puts out this order, find all the babies born in this area, kill them all. Kill them all. I don't like the threat. I don't like the words, where's the new king? And so Jesus has to take off. You know, Mary and Joseph didn't say, hey, you know, he's the son of God, no problem, we're just staying here. No, we're running for our lives. We're going to where everyone goes to just get out of town, Egypt. I go down to Egypt. We're trying to survive. We're going to wait till this guy dies until, you know, nobody's trying to kill us anymore. So right from the beginning, he's vulnerable. You're going, how is this going to work out? What if you were reading through the Gospels for the first time? How's this going to work out? It seems like something bad could happen to him. And 400 AD, St. Augustine writes this. Amazing Christian writer. But he writes about the irony and the vulnerability of Jesus. He says, man's maker was made man, that he, ruler of the stars, might nurse at his mother's breast, that the bread might hunger, the fountain might thirst, the light sleep, the way be tired on its journey, that the truth might be accused of false witness, the teacher be beaten with whips, the foundation be suspended on wood, that strength might grow weak, that the healer might be wounded, that life might die. Amazing. It's not that safe to be here. I always thought it'd be kind of fun to go back in time with a time machine. Don't you just want to do that? Time machine, go back to your favorite place. I read a book once called Timeline by Michael Crichton. And of course, it's a fictional book. There's no real time machine. But what I noticed was you just think it's going to be fun, right? So in this book, Timeline, you get in this time machine, and they want to go back to the Middle Ages for some reason, and they do. And just as soon as they get out of the time machine, in the middle, this guy almost dies. Why? Because he can't talk right. He can't, you know, everybody's suspicious of him. He's not wearing the right clothes or anything like that. See, everything is dangerous. That's the way it is here. It's a dangerous place to be. It's not just fun. It's scary. So Jesus comes here and it's immediately dangerous and scary, and he's very vulnerable. So Augustine wrote that in AD 400. So fast forward a couple thousand years, Lucy Shaw, Christian poet, wrote this. I think it's very similar, but it has some great points. She says, older than eternity, now he's new. Now native to earth as I am, nailed to my poor planet, caught that I might be free, blind in my womb to know my darkness ended, brought to this birth for me to be newborn, and for him to see me mended, I must see him torn. So a child was born according to a plan. A child was born in a surprising way. God came to earth. A child was born making himself vulnerable for us. Let's fast forward this a couple thousand years. What would this look like today? I'll show you a little video of what this birth might look like if it happened here today. And behind it, they're reading Isaiah 9, 1 through 7. Let's take a look.
The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult, and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. For to us, a child is born. To us, a son is given. And the government shall be upon his shoulder. And his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of Hosts will do this.
So God had a plan, and his surprising plan was that he decided to come in person. You know, Jesus tells the parable about all through the Old Testament, you know, all these prophets coming and they either get rejected or killed or whatever. He says, then finally the Son came in person. So God has a plan, and he sprinkles hints about this plan all through the Old Testament so that those who are reading can see where it's going to show up. And then he decides to come in a way that he's going to be very vulnerable. And the last point I want to make is that he comes to rescue us. Sometimes people consider becoming Christians. And I remember when I was thinking about becoming a Christian, I was thinking, do I have to get a really big black Bible and carry that around and throw my brain away and just do all the stuff that all the Christians do? And because I wondered, if I give my life to Jesus Christ, what's he going to do with it? Is he really good? But that's not really the picture the Bible gives us. The picture the Bible gives us is not that if we accept Jesus, it'll just make our life a little better or give us, you know, something to sing about at Christmas. He comes because we're in prison, you know, and we kind of think, well, I'm not in prison. You know, I'm fine. I'm free. I can do all this stuff. My life's good, and I just want to make it a little better. And God says, no. Yes, there are a lot of good things in your life, but you don't realize there's a sense in which you're in prison. And I love what this one person said about Advent. They said, Advent is like a prison cell. We can bring that up. In which one waits and hopes and does various things, but is completely dependent on the fact that the door of freedom has to be opened from the outside. We're in this prison, and we need somebody to open the door because we can't do it. I can't do it. You can't do it. Somebody's got to come to rescue us and to open the door from the outside. And that's what he came to do. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. He came according to plan. He came in a surprising way that God would show up himself. He came to make himself vulnerable, and he came to rescue you and me. And if you're thinking about Jesus, then what he would say is, I have come to rescue you, and you don't have to do anything special. When I open the door, which I've already done, all you have to do is step out. It's a gift. I know it's almost too hard to believe, but I've come for you. I love you. I've done everything you need. All you need to do is say yes. I've come and lived the life you should have lived, and I've died the death you should have died, and I've risen again. And now I'm just saying to anyone who will, come to me. Jesus offers himself as a gift, and all you need to do is receive him. Let's pray. Jesus, we thank you for coming to rescue us. We thank you for the passion it took to come all this way, and the risk and the vulnerability and the pain. We don't fully understand your love for us, but we celebrate it.